The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the first Tech Weekly in March. Each week we descend upon Guardian Towers to record the latest and the greatest in technology news, views, and rumors. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me in the studio are the magnificent Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. I attended a lecture last week during the Brighton Science Festival by the Institute of Unnecessary Research, where I learned about an extraordinary project that converts brain waves into MIDI signals. I thought it was fascinating. First of all, it was a sort of basic thing where, you know, you've got your kind of how your brain sounds, and then they
sound like static actually.
And then they gave the guy a chili, like the hottest chili in the world.
I'm wondering where this is going.
Basically where it was going was, I thought I'd engage you both in conversation and find out that if you were a funder, what unnecessary research would you support?
I think the unnecessary research, we've just been upgraded here to the latest version of Adobe in copy and InDesign and everything, and my unnecessary research would be, which idiot at Adobe thought that between the version 2 and version 3 you should change all the commands if you're writing a script to search and replace, so that what could be done in one line in the version 2 now takes 3 lines.
Yeah, exactly. Jemima, do you have any kind of research?
I'm still reeling from the wonder of stairs as an invention. If anyone
simple
could talk
pleasures,
about it.
Simple pleasures.
Yeah. Well, it sort of got in the way of the wheel, though, didn't it?
Coming back to the point, remember technology? Anyway, it's been a week when a university in St. Louis, Missouri discovered that robotic dogs could relieve loneliness as much as the real thing, and the MOD warned that robots could be used as terrorists to destroy lives. Conflicting PR, I think, for the robot industry. Can you imagine what would happen if the two were combined? But we're not going to talk about terrorist dogs or kindly robots this week. No, we're talking artificially intelligent search engines and safe web surfing. We're also welcoming freeagentcentral.com into the lift for this week's elevator pitch. We're learning about the news and listening to your feedback. It's going to be a killer show. If we are to believe the bleeding headlines of 1,000 tabloids, the internet is responsible for the downward spiral of society. From social isolation to suicide cults, the internet gets a really bad rep. But there are some dodgy rabbit holes out there, booby traps that can lead you down, down, down into the dark corners of the web, places Middle England don't have the capacity to dream about. And in that we don't have a solid grasp on the effects of interacting with such media, it is sensible to play cautious. Jemima, you interviewed Stephen Balcombe from the Family Online Safety Group. What did he have to say?
Well, FOSI is just one organisation that's looking into ways of protecting children online. It's just one element of kind of online safety that's very important. And obviously the Byron report is being anticipated later this month. So I spoke to him to ask what he's working on and how FOSI is tackling these problems. They've just launched a task force, which is kind of a meshing together of various universities and big companies like Google, AOL and Microsoft, and notably MySpace as well, to try and come up with some online safety tools. And so I asked him if he could outline the current focus of their work.
It's a three-pronged approach. Government has got to take up reasonable oversight and support for this issue. Industry has got to do more in terms of self-regulating and providing the kind of tools that parents can use. And the nonprofit sector has got to continue to innovate and to reach parents, teachers, and children with timely online safety messages.
And how difficult is it to reach parents and kids? And if you're trying to educate both of those, aren't kids much more savvy than parents nowadays?
Well, it is very difficult to reach busy parents, typically, who have got an awful lot of other things going on their plate. And also you have a generational gap. I mean, literally, kids are fearless and the parents are clueless. And that's a very, very difficult thing to breach. And it makes it particularly awkward for parents to talk to their children about it when they feel themselves somewhat at a loss as to what it is their kids are doing.
So what would you recommend for confused parents then, who are trying to work out exactly how to navigate their children? I think you mentioned a contract that you offer that parents and kids can sign.
The very first thing to say is you must talk with your kids. It's more than the birds and the bees conversation. It's more than just that one time, you know, embarrassing talk about sex. This is an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing conversation with your kids. And one of the tools that we offer on our site is an a family safety contract. And it goes through a number of points that the child themselves have to agree to and sign. And then a number of points the parents go through and they have to agree to and sign. And including in that is the parents saying that they themselves will get interested and will go online with their children and get involved with the kids' online lives. They will also monitor from time to time, and they may, if the kids are young enough, will filter stuff that they don't want their kids to see.
And in families where parents maybe don't have the time or they're really completely technophobic, I suppose that means working more with schools and with government. I suppose that comes down to regulation and to the responsibility of governments to put basic standards in place.
I don't know if it's necessarily a case of regulation, but it is a case of governments getting out the big meta messages. You know, clunk, click every trip. We had that back in the 70s. The no smoking kind of messages that we've had from government over the years. I think we need to boil some of these messages down to very, very simple phrases that parents can quickly and easily understand. And then work with the schools. The schools are a critical part of this because that is where kids spend a lot of their time, after all. They also spend a lot of time online at schools. And as a way to back that up, for schools to be able to give material to take home for their parents to read. Because I'm afraid way too much is put online for parents who never actually get to see it.
Are the sites themselves doing enough, do you think, to look after the kids that are really drawn to these sites?
Yes and no. I think there's some real leaders on this. I know that companies like AOL and Microsoft and Yahoo have for nearly a decade now been real leaders in the field in terms of online safety. But there are an awful lot of other sites that either do very little or absolutely nothing at all. And I think those are the ones, particularly the social networking sites, which are currently in the headlights, if you will, of government attention, of media attention, and rightly so, because there are an awful lot of kids doing things on social networking sites that perhaps they shouldn't do or they're too naive to realize will get them into trouble later. And a lot more needs to be done, both by the sites themselves, but also in terms of the general education we were just talking about.
Is there a cultural gap between what's happening in the UK and the US?
There isn't a lot of regulation of internet content on either sides of the Atlantic. There are some very good rules about illegal material like child pornography and predation that exists on both sides. This is a far more difficult and subtle area, the area of legal but potentially harmful content, or for that matter, activity like bullying, which is not quite criminal behavior but could lead to that kind of thing. The UK is probably the number one country in terms of developing safety messages, safety tools, that plus the Home Office Task Force. You've got an awful lot of ingredients that would go into making this probably one of the safest countries to go online. I'm afraid we have an awful lot to do to catch up in the United States, while on the other hand, there's a lot of good technological innovation going on there. And there are very good examples of online safety messages and methods, but it's not joined up in the way that I can see that it is here.
The Byron Report, it's been talked about for a very long time now. What are you expecting that the report's going to deliver that's really going to make a concrete difference to the work you've been doing?
Well, I have to say I've been very impressed by Dr. Byron. I've had a lengthy conversation with her on the phone. I had lunch with her yesterday. I'm meeting with her again today. She and her office could not be more open and transparent and willing to listen. I have not a clue what she's going to say, although I get an impression that she understands the complexity of the issue. My guess is that she won't come out for radical moves to regulate the industry. My guess is that she will say that there will be a combination of responsibilities that need to be increased from government and industry and the parents themselves, and not forgetting schools too. Where she may come out with the video games ratings is anyone's guess. And I know that's quite controversial here. And, we're going to be fascinated to see what comes out.
This is a really, really fascinating discussion that we could be having about this right now. But I think one of the One of the things that you brought up, Jemima, in that interview is, you know, aren't kids savvy enough? Don't they know when they're that there are weirdos online? You know, don't they see them flying giant flags a mile away?
I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine who has a 10-year-old, and I said, I remember being 10, and actually your view on the world is actually very sophisticated. And he said, I thought the same until I saw how my own 10-year-old acted online. And despite his son being very well briefed on all the information that he shouldn't give, his son was giving away the name of his school, he was giving away his home address.
So it wasn't as if he was posting it, you know, to a group or whatever.
No, it's a specific person. And that's quite terrifying.
Yeah.
That said, I do think there's always been a sense that as kids grow up and learn how to develop those relationships with other people, they need to have their own space that's distinct from their parents. It's really essential, and they have that space to develop relationships with friends. So it's an incredibly complex area. And when teachers have got so much on their plate, I can't imagine that kind of internet culture is really that high a priority, but it does need to be.
At the minute, though, we're kind of, this Fosse's approach and also what we're talking about is kind of not giving enough credence to the teachers. Part of the key stages is to create this understanding of internet, is to create internet safety spaces. And when I was doing a research report about computer technologies and the internet and schools and curriculum-based education, one of the largest areas that they were very keen to emphasize was the safety component. So perhaps, you know, schools are already getting involved with this. Is there really a place for Fosse in this sphere?
Can you ever have too many initiatives? They're particularly good at coordinating this kind of triangulation, if you like, of the industry and academia and regulation. And somebody's got to be doing that, even if it's like herding cats.
But really what you need to do is to get kids to question everything. But that's something that doesn't really sit very well with schools, where what they'd really want the children to do is just learn everything.
And on that note, let's learn about the news.
Let's. Microsoft was slapped with the biggest ever regulatory fine for a single company last week as the EU imposed a further penalty of £680 million. The Competition Commissioner has imposed a total 1.7 billion euros in fines on the software giant for failing to offer affordable interoperability to third-party services. Google is not immune to the economic downturn, it appears. Companies' shares have fallen 38% in 3 months, dropping last week after Comscore data showed its essential paid search advertising volume had fallen. The California court judge who ordered the closure of whistleblower's website WikiLeaks has reversed his decision, declaring on Friday that he had concerns the move was unconstitutional. Julius Baer, the Swiss bank that issued the injunction, contested that private and commercially sensitive information was published on the site. But then, that's the point. Netscape, that early icon of the web, is disappearing from the internet as we speak. AOL stopped support for the browser on Saturday, recommending that users upgrade to Firefox or Flock instead. Not, it must be noted, Internet Explorer. The US government has begun spying on gamers to try and seek out terrorists. Project Reynard will initially research standard patterns of user behaviour and then try to identify what it calls terrorist dynamics. Woot!
Thank you very much, Jemima. That's a lot of news this week, but all very interesting. My particular interest was in the World of Warcraft gamers as terrorists suggestion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's preposterous, I say. Well, actually, it brings up something that Charles, you were talking about last week when we were talking about the internet service providers and we were talking about the music. Who is it that gamers would be able to complain to if, you know, they happen to be a rogue somebody in World of Warcraft and somebody points out that they're acting funny and now they can't get into the US?
How exactly would a terrorist play an online game differently? I don't get it.
One of the things I think that they're looking at is the trade of goods, because these things have real money value. So they're going to be following how US dollars are transacted.
I mean, if it's,
with
it's
miracle
either,
swords.
Yeah, it's
scabbard
either that or also going to be looking at all the griefers who go around and just sort of, you know, plan these massive plots to destroy things in order to upset as many people. I mean, hell, you know, if you really want the terrorists of World of Warcraft, it's all the griefers, isn't it? It's all the griefers.
Are they really online? Aren't they all in training camps in Derbyshire or somewhere?
Actually, what I wanted to talk a little bit more about closely was WikiLeaks. Can you tell me a bit about that, Jemima?
Well, I've been following this quite closely. I mean, this is fascinating. So even from the word go, WikiLeaks has been quite controversial because it allows anyone anonymously to post documents that they allege might show government corruption or insider trading or, you know, anything.
Is this US-based?
The contributors actually are all over the world. They, until this court case, they haven't actually said exactly who they are, but they have servers in Belgium and I think India as well as America. So they've covered themselves for this kind of event, which is an organisation challenging them and saying, you've got information about us that's commercially damaging and sensitive, take it down now, which is exactly what did happen 2 weeks ago. The judge got an injunction and said, no, it has to be taken down. He didn't just say that information has to be taken down. He said the entire site has to be taken down and the domain name has to be removed from the registrar, which is virtually unheard of.
Well, what about, you can always roll back in time with something like the Wayback Machine and you can see these documents and all this stuff anyway.
That's a very good point. I didn't check that, actually, but it was a particularly thorough move that he seemed to take extremely quickly and without really thinking about it that much.
I'm astonished that any judge in the States would not go through the First Amendment implications of this.
Well, the press and organisations like Electronic Frontier Foundation just came down on this judge like a ton of bricks, and quite rightly so, because it is a question of free speech. It's absolutely basic. Anyway, so on Friday, 2 weeks later, he completely reversed.
What did he say? I just had a bad night the night before. Yeah.
Well, not exactly, but he did completely contradict himself by saying it does appear to raise First Amendment issues, I sort of forgot about those the first time around.
There is the reason why the bank had sued in California, because California has quite strong trade secrets laws, which is one of the reasons why Apple brought lots of its lawsuits, apart from the fact it's based there, against bloggers in California, citing that you're not allowed to give away trade secrets there. But of course, this bank doesn't have any business in California as such.
They said it was because an ex-employee of theirs has a court case ongoing in the States, and they said, it was related to that and it could damage the case. But I think it's irrelevant in this case. Craziness. Anyway, another hearing in May, so we'll see what his final decision is then.
Thank you very much to both of you. You can read about these stories and more on the web at guardian.co.uk/technology. Searching the internet for exactly what you're looking for can be a challenging task. Once, for example, this is my favorite example, I was looking for a Turkish bath near my house and typed in Brighton plus sauna. I got something really...
Well, hello.
It was very different. And, I should have expected this, but I just didn't. What if there was a search engine that somehow knew that I actually did want to go to a sauna, a hot room? Charles, you met with True Knowledge, a Cambridge-based search company that hopes to use the power of the semantic web and disambiguation projects to make searching the world much easier.
I met William Tunstall Pedder, who's the founder of True Knowledge. It looks like a search engine. I've got to say I get loads of emails, regular emails, a couple of months probably, people saying, I've got a new search engine. Would you like to try it out? And I say, not really, thanks. There's a big one already out there, letter G, something like that, which does it pretty well. But this is slightly different because it treats the whole idea of searching and knowledge in a different way. On the outside, it sort of looks like a search engine. So I asked William Tunstall Pedder, if it looks like a search engine, is that what it's trying to be?
You can use it as a search engine, but we aren't actually indexing web pages. What we're doing is something that's complementary to web searching. We're building a repository of the world's knowledge that's in a form that computers can process. And when somebody types in a query, we consult that first. And if the knowledge is there, it can produce a perfect answer. And if not, it can fall back to keyword searching on the web.
So if it doesn't know what the answer is to what you're asking, then it goes out and polls all the search engines out there?
One of the things the website does is it has a search engine feed into it. So it has somebody else's search engine results, which can be produced, as well as the results from our technology. Essentially addresses one of the fundamental issues in internet search, which is that computers don't understand the contents of web pages. So if you want to find something else on the internet, you have to guess keywords, and this is iterative process of reading through external websites. It can't just respond directly and make inferences using knowledge that it understands.
An example you give on your website is if you're trying to find out if Jennifer Lopez is single, then and you type in Jennifer Lopez single into a very large, well-known search engine, then you get lots of results for what her latest music offering
is. Yeah, that's a very good example. Because the search engine doesn't understand natural language, it doesn't understand English text, all it can do is give pages that have a statistical correlation with the question. Well, with our technology, the fact that she's married is in there, who she's married to, and our technology can infer that therefore she is not single and give you a direct answer, no, and cite the facts that are used to do that. And knowledge can be added by users as well. So if that fact is wrong, you can correct it and you can add knowledge to the repository from within the website.
When I tried it out on a well-known search engine, as you say, you get the Jennifer Lopez single, you get a gazillion results about her latest offering. But then I thought, what am I trying to find out? Jennifer Lopez married, and I got this the answer I was looking for pretty fast.
Yes, if you've experienced with keyword searching, you can generally pick keywords that will eventually find the result. That example was chosen as an example of something that it should, in theory, be very easy to find out using a search engine that's indexed those pages.
It sounds like you're trying to build a Wikipedia, but a Wikipedia that a computer understands.
Exactly. That's right. So it's one way of thinking about what we're doing is it's a Wikipedia for facts. It's a Wikipedia for knowledge that computers can process. Because it's in a form that computers can process, computers can also ask questions of our website as well. At the moment, there is nowhere on the internet that computers, automated systems, can go to find out information in a general way. If they go to a search engine, they get back documents which they can't make sense of. Another application of our technology is computer questions.
So what then is your ultimate aim for what you're producing here?
Well, the ultimate aim is to build a big repository of knowledge that becomes the central place on the internet for human and computer questions.
And how would you look to monetize this?
We have a website. It's currently in private beta. We have a thousand or so external people testing the site for us. That will eventually be a public site that anybody can use, and that gets monetized with contextual advertising, much in the same way as search engines do. And for computer questions, we'll eventually have some kind of subscription model.
It seems to me one of the key differences between what Wikipedia has and what you're talking about here is that with Wikipedia, when I go to look for a page about Jennifer Lopez, then I can see what sort of facts it has about her. And if I happen to know because, she got divorced this week or something, then one can change it right there. It's a bit more difficult to see with your system, isn't it, what facts it actually has and what their interrelationship is?
That's not quite true. I mean, one of the things that we have in our website is summary information pages about all the entities that are in there. So if you just typed in Jennifer Lopez, you would get an information screen that showed key facts about her. And there are different information screens depending on what emphasis you wanted. So for the human being entity, the basic one shows place of birth and residence, but there's one that's biased towards family or dietary preferences. So you can browse through the knowledge base in a similar way to the way you'd browse through Wikipedia.
And can I change that if I happen to know?
Absolutely. In fact, that's another advantage of our technology compared with Wikipedia. It's because the facts are in a structured form that the computer understands. It's much more robust against abuse and changes. So if something's wrong, it can be corrected in a much more a stable way than with Wikipedia, where you have these reversion wars where, because the computer doesn't understand the change, the only way of correcting abuse or vandalism is for somebody else to change it back. But because in our system the knowledge is understood, it won't allow facts in that are semantically incompatible with other knowledge without the other knowledge being changed.
In effect, you get a sort of circle where it compares all the different facts against each other and says this one stands out as being wrong.
Yeah, for example, there's a fact in the knowledge base that says that Jennifer Lopez, so we're talking about her, is born in New York. If somebody were to say she was born in Chicago, the system would know that that is incompatible with the fact that she's born in New York because it knows that Chicago and New York are geographically distinct. But if somebody were to come along and say she was born in Manhattan, say, it does know that that is compatible with her being born in New York. It's a more accurate version of New York. So that fact would be allowed in. And once that fact has been established with enough evidence, with enough different sources, it would be very difficult for somebody to come along and vandalise that bit of knowledge by asserting something that wasn't true.
And I suppose equally that if someone was to take whoever her husband this week is and to say that he was now single, whereas the Jennifer Lopez entry said that he and she were married, that would show up as an incongruity, would it?
It would do, except for the fact she might get divorced. So the system does understand about permanent and transient knowledge. So the is married to relationship, it knows, is transient, it can change. So it could be that she's single because she's recently become divorced, while her place of birth, for example, it knows is permanent. So it knows that that can't change. So that, yes, some facts can be updated because of changes that happen over time, and some facts are permanent.
How long are you expecting to stay in private beta? When are you going to open this out to the rest of the world?
That's still to be determined. There's a few things that we're expanding as fast as we can. We've had an awful lot of really good feedback from our early beta testers, and we're getting lots of knowledge going into the repository, which is great. But there's all sorts of small issues that we've discovered as well. So we're still to determine when it's going to be a public site, but hopefully later this year.
That was William Tunstall Peddo, founder of True Knowledge. Now, Charles, does it actually work?
It does certainly work. I mean, the thing that's interesting is that it's trying to build a self-contained view of the world. And I think that that's got real interesting implications for, you know, you take that sort of chunk of storage and you stick it into something which could be, you know, self-propelling. You have a robot which basically knows how the world is.
But it's got to be huge, though, hasn't it, to be effective? I mean, to what extent can they sort of quantify how much of that information they need to do and how much they have done?
Don't know. How much do toddlers need to sort of know how to get around the world?
Well, it's a kind of fact equivalent of a dictionary of all the known relevant words that we use. I mean, they're compiling a database of all the relevant known facts.
But also all of the connections. So it's not just the words. Yeah. It's like, you know, this happens to be connected with this, happens
to
that.
Nightmare.
So it takes
it's the connections that are important, not the facts in some senses. You know, it's really the, you know, what's useful about a view of the world, you know, as humans build it up, is that we know how the facts interrelate. And when things don't fit together, we say, hey, that doesn't make sense. I mean, there have been lots of experiments in artificial intelligence projects down the years to try to create a sort of consciousness is the wrong word, but schema which holds all the knowledge about a certain situation and can describe it. There were lots of experiments like this at MIT in the 1980s, and this is sort of trying to do it in a semantic way with lots of facts. But, you know, bear in mind that storage is damn cheap, processing is getting cheaper all the time, and if you get people putting all this sort of information in, that's a free resource there.
Isn't that the problem? I mean, a lot of the semantic web disambiguation projects that are out there require a lot of early adopter work. So how likely is it, do you think, that people are going to jump on this bandwagon in the same way that, for example, they jumped on Wikipedia?
I would have thought that they could certainly bootstrap on Wikipedia. You know, why not just download the whole lot of Wikipedia, start trying to make some semantic sense of it? You'll see
exactly
which bit
fits what I was going to suggest.
Ah, you see, great minds.
I can see both of you with your connections and your minds. Yeah. I have a regular discussion with a friend about the types of people that we'd want on a panel who would create the ultimate in artificial intelligence. And we've talked about actors, we've talked about thieves, we've talked about philosophers, ethicists. These people are trying to create a kind of artificial intelligence. They're trying to create a semantic space that thinks, that tries to think for what you think you are thinking about before you think about it, if you see what I mean. Would they fall onto your ultimate artificial intelligence panel?
Yeah, sure. Though I'd like to know how thieves would do it.
Oh, they'd be really interesting. They'd try and break it, wouldn't they?
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that's enough of my thoughts. Thank you both very much for that and very interesting conversation there. I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about artificial intelligence in the future. And also thank you very much to William Tunstall Peddo, founder of True Knowledge. It's time to welcome another victim into the elevator cage.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Which floor would you like?
Accounts department, please. I think it's on the fifth floor.
Going up.
So, who are you and what's your company?
I'm Ed Molyneux. I'm from Free Agent Central.
OK, then. Explain your business to my mum in two sentences.
We do online money management for freelancers. It's an online streamlined service to help freelancers manage their time tracking and expense tracking and billing and the money going in and out of their bank accounts and that sort of stuff.
First floor.
So how do you make money?
Well, it's a subscription-based service. So we get people to sign up. They get a 30-day free trial. And if they like what they see, then they sign up for a subscription.
How many users do you have now? And what's your target within 12 months?
We have 500 users on board at the moment. And we don't really have any idea about how fast this thing's going to grow. We've seen a lot of activity this week. So we are hoping to be targeting, you know, a couple of thousand by this time next year.
Second floor.
And tell me where you're based.
We're all over the place. I'm based in Edinburgh. Our design guy is also in Edinburgh. We have a tech guy who works down in London. And a lot of our business development stuff is done from out in Spain, so we've really kind of dotted all over the place.
Okay, so who are you competing with?
Well, there's a few other services out there which do kind of online time tracking and online invoicing. I think in some ways our biggest competitors is the humble spreadsheet or even pen and paper. I think sometimes people see things also like Sage and QuickBooks, all these other proper accounting packages, and to be honest, nobody can make head nor tail of them. So in a lot of ways, that's not really our competition. It's back to the spreadsheet that we're competing with, which is great because put us alongside a spreadsheet and, you know, we look just fantastic.
Fourth floor.
And if you had £10 million to invest in any company other than your own, what would you invest in?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think I've seen some really exciting things in the last few months. And one thing I saw the other day was this thing called School of Everything. And it's a way of trying to link up part-time teachers with people who are interested in what they're teaching. So people teaching anything from knitting to piano and all this sort of stuff. And it's all map-based, so you can see, you know, if you're looking for your piano teacher, you can see somebody within 15 miles of where you are. I think it's a really great idea, and I think it deserves to go global.
What's the weirdest business experience you've had so far?
Oh, we've never been together, all four of us. I don't think we've ever had more than three of us in the same room at once. And it just seems totally amazing to me that this virtual company that we've built practically still manages to get so much done. I think that's pretty extraordinary.
Fifth floor, doors opening.
That was Ed Molyneux from freeagentcentral.com. Jemima, are you sold?
I think it's quite interesting. It's kind of accounting meets Web 2. He's got a really good point that his main competitor is Excel, because everybody I know that's a freelancer uses Excel. And he's got an even better point that Sage and all those others are just far more complicated than they need to be. Mm. And I think it's quite a canny proposition. It's designed for either sole traders or people with no more than three employees. It packages up all of your accounts and then gets them ready for the tax man at the end of the year. Whether he'll be able to convince people to stop using Excel, and also I think there's a kind of privacy issue. There's a sort, you have to have confidence.
I was going to say that.
Do you trust the cloud?
But yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on it. But if anyone out there is using this or plans to use this, would be interested to hear how it works in practice and whether it's a bind having to go online all the time or whether it's a benefit.
Charles, would you give up your database for this?
Well, I when I was freelance a couple of years ago, I actually just wrote a little database and a sort of little website which runs on my own computer, which holds all my accounts from, you know, years back and forward. And I suppose it's just the problem of exporting everything. I think the problem is more, how do you make people import all their stuff into your WYSI Web 2.0 thing? Because once they're doing that, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's actually getting over that hurdle and getting there, which is the difficult part. I think it would be an interesting question as to, you know, people who do their company accounts on a spreadsheet on their computer, how secure is it? Mm-hmm. Are you really confident that the password is good enough, that the spreadsheet is encrypted, that only the right people can get at it if your computer's stolen? You know, so it may actually be that the web version is more secure than the one on your computer.
If you fancy getting into the lift yourself with the lovely Jemima, please email her with your elevator pitches only, please, at jemima.kish@guardian.co.uk. I think we've been spouting our opinions enough for this week. Let's hear some of yours. Keith on the Games blog wrote that the Department for Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee thinks that age ratings should be the responsibility of developers, but they still have trouble deciding how to keep harmful material out of the hands of kids. So this kind of pulls on the family online safety thing and also some of the stuff we've been talking about the past couple of weeks. Billy Brush, one of our regulars, doesn't have much faith in the BBFC as somebody who can certify. He says, in a country that banned Manhunt 2 the week Hostel 2 came out, I don't believe us games consumers can have any confidence that games will get a fair deal in relation to other media. That's so glaringly obvious already, it makes me extremely defensive, and the full details of this report aren't even out. What is clear is that PEGI, which is the Pan-European Games Voluntary Commission, and not the BBFC, are up to rating games appropriately. BBFC love film. They even have a preview theater for film buffs. They don't treat games like film, as some believe. They treat them like a very poor cousin. Even if they don't want to rate them, then the government can hopefully suggest publishers go the PEGI route. He had a lot to say on the subject, didn't he?
He
clearly did. Jemima, what did you have to... What's going on in digital content this week?
Microsoft's fine. That got everybody a bit riled. And everyone likes to lay in and say, they deserve it. At the end of the comment stream, we had a couple of quite interesting ones. Avro said, Microsoft depends on some doofus trotting off to PC Warehouse and buying whatever the 18-year-old expert advises, which I thought was a bit harsh. But then he said, the problem for them is that the doofus increasingly has friends running OS X and Linux and not suffering from the shortcomings of Windows. He starts to read computer magazines and realises that Windows is not necessary to browse the internet, read and write emails, and do a bit of word processing. Microsoft knows that soon they won't be able to palm off third-rate software on an ignorant public. And that's what the whole Yahoo purchase is about, which is quite interesting.
Well, ours was on a post that Jack Schofield put up saying, asking the question, has the European Commission jumped the shark on Microsoft? Basically, you know, imposing a fine when there was really no need to because Microsoft had sort of come into line and all these things. And after a fair bit of back and forth, NJRQ came in with, good Lord, you're right, Jack. Let me immediately say as many nice things about Microsoft as I can. One, Windows doesn't complain if you just pull out a flat drive. Okay.
Like comedy timing, beautiful. I could see you in the stand-up clubs across the world, or like Robin Williams at the TED conference.
Oh, yes.
You could do that. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone. That's all from you, the listeners and the commentators. Do feel free to let your opinions be heard, though, all week at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/games/digital-content.
I'm James Randerson, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we'll analyse the controversy behind the claims that Prozac and other antidepressants provide almost no medical benefit. Plus, to opt in or opt out, we discuss the ethics and politics of organ donation. And we brace ourselves for an invasion of brainless invertebrates. That's not because the Spice Girls are dropping by, but we will be telling you about the best science songs of all time. It's all on the new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Charles, what's in this week's tech section?
Well, I'll be looking at a deal that BT, Virgin and TalkTalk, who are the three biggest ISPs in the UK, have done with a company called Form, P-H-O-R-M, where basically they'll send your whole click stream, all the search terms you go, you enter into search pages, the web pages that you visit, and they'll use it to categorise you using a cookie on your browser, and they say target you with more relevant ads. It's very, got a lot of comment on the blogs already. We're looking at a new colourisation technique for old episodes of Doctor Who, Top of the Pops and Dad's Army and other BBC programs which were recorded in colour, but they then didn't keep the colour tapes. They had transmitted them on black and white. Now they're restoring the colour, so now you can see what Jimmy Savile's hair really looked like in 1969. An examination of how much cheaper and how much bigger the sort of Linux laptops like the RM MiniBook could get in the coming years, and why they'll have an advantage over Windows. How computers in the office are turning into consumer-owned things. In effect, company IT is giving up the losing fight of trying to make people conform to its rules and letting people act as if they own the computers. Seth Finkelstein is looking at whether the internet can really change anything, and I'm making the case for building lots and lots of nuclear power plants.
Very interesting. That will all be out on Thursday. And on next week's podcast, we welcome Bobby back. He was indisposed this week, contrary to what we said last week. And Jemima has something clearing in her throat. But you're also going to be going to South by Southwest next week.
I am going to South by Southwest indeed. There are three of us going, one to cover music, one for film, and I'll be covering interactive. So we'll have audio and interviews and blogging and galore.
It'll be fantastic. I hope I'll give you the name of a really good line dancing bar.
Please do. No, seriously, I'm well up for it. Could I just say as well, we got mad props from Gaping Void on Twitter. So right back at you.
And also, actually, Vic Keegan's son, Vic didn't even realise, but his son listens to the podcast. Aww. I went, Dad! What? Shouting out to Chris. Anyway, thank you very much to our guests and Jemima and Charles and, of course, our producer, Scott. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we look forward to speaking at you again next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.